All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? How are you? Mark Maron here. You back at work? How's it going? I know, right? Right? You get relaxed. You get sort of into a different time sense. You get into a different groove. You kind of get grounded in who you are and your identity in the world. And now you're back. You're back at work, making the adjustment, checking the mountain of emails. Everything all right? You're gonna be okay today? Just hang in there, you know. I guess this is life. We're all pretty excited, right? Y'all got pretty excited, and now we're, what, 7 days into it? And I don't know why we fool ourselves every year. Maybe it's just the ritual. Maybe we actually know in our hearts that, it might be a little better. It might be a signpost of some kind, but really just another day, and now we're a week into it, and we're back. We're back at it. Maybe you took that time to think about, what would it be like if I didn't have to work? I think about that all the time. I am constantly working, and I don't know how to really not work, because I don't know about you, but I get about 10 days away, and then it's just an existential whirlpool of possibilities. None of them good, but welcome back. Welcome back to work, folks. Let's have at it. Today, Steve Coogan is on the show. Great guest, great guy, and a great movie he's in, actually, Stan and Ollie. It's Steve playing Stan Laurel and John C. Reilly playing Oliver Hardy. I loved it. I fucking love that movie. I will recommend that. I recommend that movie. I will, and I am recommending the movie Stan and Ollie. I'll talk about it before I bring him on. I certainly will talk about it with Steve, but I just thought it was a beautiful little film, really. Well acted and just beautifully shot, and I don't know, man. Maybe I'm getting soft. I don't know if I'm. I just found it very touching. Maybe as a performer, as somebody in the business, marginally, I found Stan and Ollie to be a tremendous movie. All right, so I had to watch a bunch of movies because of an interview I'm working on, and some of these movies were difficult movies. And I'm not a closed-minded person, and it's interesting to not be a closed-minded person. Because when you're not closed-minded, when you're open-minded, you may have resistance to things, but you know, the thing is if you let things in because you're open-minded and you're curious and you're interested and you reserve judgment, until you process it, you know, you live a fuller, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual life, I believe. Because you take a lot of things in and you can sort of, you know, compare things and feel things, different things, and decide, you know, who you are in relation to them and what's, you know, what's good for you and what's not good for you and how do you accept other people and, you know, like what are things that are difficult. And I just think that being open-minded is a stronger position. But it is interesting that with that comes a certain amount of insecurity in the sense that I guess the example is... Like I was watching some early films by Yorgos Lanthimos, and I probably should talk about this when I give you the interview, but it's on my mind, and it does lead to somewhere else. Well, I'm watching some of his films. I'm watching an early one, and I do not understand it. I don't know what the fuck is happening. I do not. I know that there is intent in it, that there was design to it, but it's not making sense to me. And it's provocative, but it's disturbing, and it's not forming a story. And I'm getting frustrated, and it's taking me days to get through a movie. And I'm open, and I want to understand, and I want to know what is trying to be communicated to me or what the effect is supposed to be. And I'm overthinking it, obviously. But the thing I noticed about myself is that if I don't understand a movie or if something is too challenging creatively, like if it's an art film and I'm not getting it, I rarely, if ever, blame the movie. I always think like, why don't I fucking get this? What is wrong with me? And sometimes it's just supposed to go in. Sometimes art is just supposed to go in and roll around in your brain a little bit. May not make any sense whatsoever, but you never know what it's going to start in your brain. You never know what it's going to tumble or trigger or morph into, or how it's going to pop back at you, or how it's going to resonate, or how it changes the way you see things. And you got to let that happen. It's not going to hurt you, especially if you don't get it and it's not expecting anything from you. But My point is, I always think that I'm the idiot. You know, you watch a movie, you're like, ah, fuck. What was that? I'm a fucking idiot. And then I realize, well, maybe that's what art's supposed to do. Maybe you're supposed to walk away going like, I'm a fucking moron. And then think about it for the next few years and off for the next decade after that. And one day you'll be like, oh, that's just like that thing in that movie. I didn't get the movie, but now like, see, now I'm looking at life a little differently, but it took 10 years. So keep an open mind. What fascinates me about closed-minded people, especially in reaction to what's going on politically, is most open-minded people can weigh things and process things based on their own experience, you know, and their own willingness to be empathetic and engage in a bigger world. So they have more foundation to understand who they are and who other people are and who they and what the world looks like and what is compassionate and what isn't. I believe that to be true. So ironically, you know, open-minded people are in a stronger position because it amazes me how easy it is with closed-minded people, how easily manipulated they are and how easily mind-fucked they are and how easily misled they are. And they think they're right. But they are the most vulnerable, mushed-brained people that I can even conceive of. And they lock into it. Because, you know, belief offers them a portal into being connected to something bigger than themselves that they don't, you know, if it speaks to their anger, they're on board no matter how wrong it is. And that's what happens. Because the open-minded thing, if you're an open-minded person, you can weigh things and process things and somewhat to see the difference between, you know, right and wrong and moral and immoral on a human level. Whereas if you're closed-minded, if somebody just pops that brain open and they dump a bunch of angry shit in there, you're fully on board with a whole fucking ideology. So closed-minded people are much more vulnerable to being mind-fucked than open-minded people. And I think in that balance, you know, lies the future of fucking humanity. The wall. The wall. What a ridiculous fucking, it's literally, this is it. This is like some sort of strange last stand of a particular type of ideology. May win, may not. The wall. Build the wall between you and your neighbors, between you and your higher mind. But whatever the case, this is the fight of the day. And I kind of hope, I certainly don't want the Democrats to cave because God knows there's a lot of different things you can do with $5 billion that are more proactive. Obviously, immigration has to be reckoned with, but that's not the point. The point is, I hope that this guy, I hope that King Baby gets his way and finds his money. I hope he just figures out a way that whether we agree with it or not, he gets it. And my hope for the wall is that it just gets half built. Maybe not even half, maybe a third built, because I think that all Trump wants as a legacy is something built, because there's a real good chance that his legacy is just going to be infamy and contempt and shame. So I think that being the builder that he is and wanting to take care of his contracting buddies, you know, he wants to get something up that he can put his name on. That's the wall. That's the Trump wall. That motherfucker, he did it. He did it. I just hope that he gets started and then it just craps out. It doesn't get done. And then like years later, when everybody has turned on him except for the 35% of the closed-minded, mind-fucked minions, they'll never go away. But history does not view tyrants in a positive way, I think, generally speaking, except for a small contingent of people. But I just hope that wall just becomes this weird monument to failure and shame and humor. I just hope that it's in the future, the half wall, the famous half Trump wall. People travel miles to see just this wall that just stops somewhere down at the bottom of Texas. And they're explaining to their kids, yeah, we had this madman was president and he had this big idea. But he didn't follow through with it. Well, what happened to him, mommy? Oh, he died in prison. Yeah, it's a hell of a story. You'll probably learn about it in school. You wouldn't have if he was president and it was successful, but you will now. So this is just, this was going to be a bigger wall. Yeah, it was supposed to go all the way across the whole bottom of the United States. And it's just this little piece. Yep. Here, hold my hand. Take a few steps. We're in Mexico now. All right, now take a few steps back. We're back in the United States. It's a big, silly wall. That's funny. He's a funny man. I don't know if I'd say that. Hey, this just didn't get done. Now it's just a monument to a horrible, dark time in our country. Come back from Mexico. Just step back over here. So, Steve Coogan is a very funny man, a very bright man, and I've been, you know, I've always liked his work. I was glad I had a chance to talk to him. But I do want to talk up this movie a little bit because I haven't been hearing much about it. I don't know. I imagine some people have seen it, but it's a lovely, touching movie about the sort of towards the end of the careers of Laurel and Hardy. And my generation, we've watched, probably got to see them on TV when we were younger. I remember in New Jersey, there was a station that ran Laurel and Hardy. My grandfather loved Laurel and Hardy, but we all certainly have a picture of Laurel and Hardy. Most of us have seen their bits before, but they're just sort of like these old timey guys who did a thing. But this movie, like, it's very hard to do a biopic in general because you have a point of reference, but we don't really have a point of reference other than those old black and white movies for Laurel and Hardy. And they did seem somewhat one-dimensional. And what Steve Coogan did and John C. Reilly did was really create Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy from the inside. And these are, I guess I'm sympathetic to it, and it's touching to me because this is a desperate time in their careers where they wound up broke because of bad production deals, and they were sort of forced to tour as a live act in Europe, and they were already past their prime. And, you know, just the conversations and the reality of being on the road and having a partnership. And it's a real, it's a beautiful movie about a friendship, and it's also a love story in a way, not a platonic love story, but the way that they just inhabited these men was really stunning, and it was shot stunning, and it was just shot beautifully, and I found it to be very touching and very moving, and they both did Oscar-worthy performances, so I just highly recommend the film, and I'll talk to Steve about it and about other things because the film does open, it's playing now in New York and California, but it opens across the world and the country on Friday, January 18th. It's called Stan and Ollie, and this is me talking to Steve Coogan. So wait, so that's the cottage is your main house?
No, it's just a house I had next to my main house, just outside Brighton.
I know nothing about Brighton. Is that nice?
It's where all the mods and the rockers had fights on the beach in the 1960s. Have you ever seen footage of
that?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You know? So it's a beach house.
It's kind of back from the beach. It's like a little cottage. You know, it's like we have lots of old, it's just an old building.
Yeah.
Loads of old buildings.
Yeah. Is it like renovated? Is it like, yeah, I mean, is the area been gentrified?
No, Brighton was always, Brighton used to be the place where people would go for dirty weekends in the 19th century.
Oh, okay. I have no sense of England, and every time I have somebody in here from England, I seem to need a history of England.
it's been going, the thing about American history is it's like 250 years old, so everybody knows it like back to front, and it just goes over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But ours is a little longer, and it gets muddier and muddier the further back you go. So nobody knows all of it. They just know little bits here and there.
Right, right. And you can always be surprised when somebody tells you something about a king or a piece of property or a house.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Like here, everyone's like so steeped in American history, they know if they don't know a part of it, they get like a rap on the knuckles.
Oh, I wish people were as educated as you're giving them credit for. It seems that here the history gets erased daily.
or rewritten.
Completely. So you grew up where, what part?
I grew up in Manchester in the north.
Oh yeah,
industrial.
It was industrial.
Yeah, like Chicago. It's like a kind of. I think I compare Manchester to Chicago.
Yeah,
lots of Irish diaspora people. I'm half, Irish. So
one of your folks is full Irish.
My mom grew up in Ireland during the war. She was sent back there. She was actually born in England, but our mom and dad were like what I call bog Irish. So
yeah.
That's super poor Irish.
Yeah.
And everybody left Ireland then. There was no work in the island.
Turn that so it's facing
the country was dying.
Yeah, yeah.
It was only actually in the population since the famine in Ireland was going down until the 1980s.
There's only like 8 million people there now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The whole country.
It was shrinking and then it went back up. Anyway, my mom's parents came over to England in the 1930s and she was born and then they sent her back during the war. So I'm on my dad's side further back is Irish. So even though I grew up in the north, there's a bunch of Irish Catholic diaspora, the kind of ghettoized area of Irish Catholics right next to the Jewish area.
In Manchester?
In North Manchester. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's a little like Chicago. I compare it to Chicago.
Yeah.
Industrial town. It was kind of gritty, little sort of dirty, but it's kind of gone beyond that now. It's like a post-industrial town, I guess.
So there was a Jewish ghetto there too?
Yeah, there's like a Jewish area right next to the Irish Catholic area.
How'd they get on? All right,
well, they didn't. They lived side by side. We didn't hang out, but we didn't fight. You know,
were they Orthodox Jews or just regular Jews?
Pretty Orthodox.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Pretty. No, regular Jews. I mean, they would assimilate more, but no, right. the Orthodox.
Is an enclave. So
yeah, and there's lots of Britain has a pretty diverse history of accommodating people of different Having said that, the Irish did have their own. There used to be signs on doors that said no blacks, no dogs, no Irish.
Oh boy,
I mean, that's they don't do that anymore, but they did once. Sure,
I mean, I talked to Cleese, John Cleese, and it sort of seemed like that the Irish were sort of they took the brunt of the humor, and they were always ostracized.
Sure, they were. Yeah, and it was okay. I mean, growing up, when I was growing up, it was all right to tell Irish jokes, funnily enough, because of the terrorism and the nationalist movement and
right now,
and no, I mean, I'm talking back in the day when the IRA was at the height.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really quite. Then it was like you were a social pariah. There were people in England pressing for the Irish. If you had to carry an ID card, if you were Irish, because you might be a terrorist.
That seems so crazy.
Well, that was way back in the day. But
it's happening now with Muslims. I mean, the exact same thing is happening.
Sure. I mean, now, of course, it's cool to be Irish. Every pub claims to be Irish. I don't know, there are not enough Irish people in the world, I think, to justify the number of Irish pubs. But
it's so weird. It's not even 100 years ago, that history, where they didn't want the Irish there. It's crazy.
I know. It's funny. In Ireland, I have two sides of my family. My dad's side of the family, his brother was wealthy, and they were targeted at one point by the IRA. The IRA used to kidnap rich people.
Oh, yeah.
Raise money from the kidnap, from the ransom, and buy arms.
Right.
And on the other side of Ireland, my mom's side of the family,
is actually the IRA.
Was people who supported the IRA who were kidnapping the same people that were targeting my dad's brother. So, and that was two sides of my family who had connections to different sides of.
I thought
of
you almost, it almost feel, felt like a setup for you saying, and that's how my parents met.
Yeah.
Do you go back there? I mean, like it would seem...
All the time, yeah. I mean, pretty regularly, sure.
I mean, I go to Ireland and I feel like some weird connection to it, and I'm full on, Ashkenazi Jew, and I can't understand what my connection is, but I go there and I'm like, I want to live here. It's so fucking
Is when you grow up in England, if you're from Ireland, it gives you a kind of anti-establishment fervor that means that you don't... I mean, for example, growing up, I felt British, and I supported the England football team and stuff, but we were always like, don't forget, the British screwed the Irish big time.
Forever.
And so we never quite bought the whole flag waving, the royal family.
Yeah.
We were kind of slightly Bolshevik, kind of like they should take them all into the cellar. But the only thing was, I think my mom and dad said, the Queen's okay. She earns, but the rest of them, they can get rid of them.
You know? The Queen's like 900 years old. She's always been there. Yeah. It's weird I don't know if it's reverence or just sort of amazement that this queen has lasted so long.
Well, longer than Victoria or any of those. I mean, you kind of, it's kind of...
Like your entire life, that's been the queen.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah, it's her, no one says his, no, I don't think anyone's old enough to remember someone saying his majesty.
Right.
Her majesty.
Yeah, and it's going to happen eventually.
Sure.
I would think by that time, no one would give a shit.
Well, it's like they keep saying, I mean, forever they were saying it's the end of the royal family. And then when Diana died, the thing was there. But, people love, they're just, I don't know, I think the British are suckers. What I find depressing about the British is a lot swathes of the working class want to be told what to do and just want to doff their caps and say, I don't want to be in charge. I don't want to empower myself. I want that guy to be in charge and tell me what to do.
That's dug into the culture.
Some aspects of the culture. I mean, look, there's a lot of the whole union movement started in the north of England. I'm very proud of that. And it's like kind of a diffidence and a kind of an opposition to established institutions.
Right.
But you know, if that was the case, then we'd have a radical government. And the fact is that we never do. We have kind of very conservative with a small C government. Because really, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how many people are banging the table. There's too many people who are just kind of roll over and say, yeah, okay, just, you know.
It's a weird thing, though, because we don't, like in this country, there's not a lot of conversation about class because they just hide it. They subvert the whole idea that there's a lower, middle, or upper class. But it's sort of established in Britain, because here it seems like people that don't have a lot, they're either angry or they think it's only a matter of time before they get it.
I know. This is the big difference, I think, between the British and the Americans. And it's the fact that they're not class obsessed. And it's a double-edged sword. There's good and bad in both. And I'll tell you what it is. In the UK, we don't measure success by the size of your bank balance.
Right.
But that means we also have snobbery. It's like we think even if you have a lot of money in Britain, people can look down their nose at you.
Sure.
If you're not from the right.
Right. If you didn't get it through the family. Or you didn't get
it. Or if you've got bad taste.
Right.
Then you ought to go to hell, kind of thing. You know? Whereas in the US, it doesn't matter. If you made money, that's it. You've arrived.
You won.
And that also means like if you made money and you're a horrible person, it doesn't matter.
You can be president.
Yeah, exactly. So it's fine. So there's a lack of snobbery in that, but it also means that you can have assholes that do very well.
Well, the lack of snobbery is essentially what's killing us culturally right now because of this fucking monster at office. I mean, he's one of those guys that was never felt like he was accepted by the people that had the money, and he had money. So he is the exact example of why snobs. That's his whole platform. It's like the elites.
I know.
But
I know.
We don't have to talk. We can't solve that problem. You grew up, I imagine, Catholic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up, I did a movie about that called Philomena about 5 years ago.
Oh, I saw that. It's great.
I mean, so I grew up Catholic, but that was my kind of way of talking about that.
That was
stuff.
A touching movie. That was I forgot. Yeah, it's a good movie. Yeah.
I mean, I have a kind of, I don't just, although there's a lot of stuff screwed up sexually, certainly about like repressed sexuality.
Right.
Hello. Yeah. Of course there is. Sure. We all know that now.
I have a theory about that. I really think that in neighborhoods, I think that some mothers who saw that their sons were heading that way, pushed them into the priesthood to save them from that life.
I think you're right. And I think some of them thought, hey, you know, and I think some guys themselves were like, I have these dark thoughts.
Yeah.
If I become a priest, they'll all go away.
I think that's true. Yeah.
And I have to say, for all the kind of horror stories, there are, and this is what Philomena was about, there are some decent people, not normally the people in charge, the people right at the base who are just trying to live a decent life and trying to do good stuff quietly.
Service.
People of simple faith. I'm not religious. I'm an atheist. But I respect those people of simple faith who just try to do the right thing without fanfare. Well,
and especially the Catholic Church and a lot of those religious institutions in general, it gets to the point where they're the only ones doing it. Like where the government won't, you know, that they're going to show up.
Sure. I mean, the thing is, I remember an article saying, I read some article about, hey, you know those guys that help out at soup kitchens and stuff like that?
Yeah.
They're not like liberal intellectuals.
Yeah.
They're people who actually are kind of helping people by giving them soup. And those, some people are in some ways socially conservative. Some of them might be, believe it or not, anti-gay marriage. Right?
Sure.
So and that's kind of, you go, well, hang on a second. Do you like those people? I'm saying that it's a lot of the people who might be not socially progressive quietly do decent stuff for people on a kind of classless basis, and don't ask, you know.
But that's part of the benefit of having a sort of faith, is that the idea of selflessness is rewarding. I mean, it's part of being human. You know, you have to train yourself to do it, but there is a benefit to it for everybody.
Yeah, I know. But it's kind of learned behavior.
I think that's
certainly
true.
Not for me. I mean, I would like to, and it's kind of weird. I would like to just go off and have a good time.
Yeah.
Part of me would just like to, you know, the thing John Lennon said, living is easy with eyes closed.
I mean,
I just want to go off and just have a good time and have a hedonistic time.
Yeah.
But then it's like, you know, anything. But I think when you, there is a thing of itself, certainly if you raise a Catholic, you've got some of the Catholic guilt.
Yeah.
That you feel, I feel like I have to, at the end of the day, the crappy stuff.
Yeah.
Is like a line of cocaine.
Yeah.
And, The good stuff is like a nourishing meal.
Right.
The line of cocaine might seem like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
But you don't get nourishment from it ultimately.
Right. And unless you do the line of cocaine, then go to feed the guys at the soup kitchen.
Yeah. Or if you're like Pablo Escobar and you sell the cocaine and use the money to buy a nourishing meal for your family. Right.
Right. Was the fear of God in you? Or was there a point in your life where you're like, I'm done with this? Or like,
yeah. I mean, I think I was super religious early on. I mean, I'd go to I was forced to go to church.
You got a lot of siblings? Do you have the full Catholic?
I've got four brothers, two sisters. They've all got kids. I got 25 nephews and nieces.
Wow.
We are a kind of, but we're a mixed bag. You know, some people don't think it's all BS. Other people are I would say, I wouldn't say devout because that sounds like a weird thing.
Yeah.
They're all liberal. Even the ones that are Catholic are liberal. And in actual fact, and we have different opinions. We're a broad church. Even the family, we get together and we love each other, but sometimes we drive each other nuts.
Of course.
And that's like a normal, marginally dysfunctional family setup like the whole world.
Yeah.
But there is a thing. I mean, I was raised a kind of socialist-ish. My parents would say Jesus was a socialist.
Right.
He hung out with the poor and he hung out with the criminals and the prostitutes.
That's the progressive line on Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And then then you get some people. What I found amazing, and it's particularly in America, is the people who manage to conflate Christianity with cash.
Yeah.
And it staggers me. They go, Jesus wanted us to make lots of money. I'm like, I don't remember reading that. I really don't.
It's an interpretation.
It's just an interpretation.
Joel Osteen, the super church guy. Yeah. There's a lot of that guy. Yeah. This empowerment.
Yeah. It's
not Christianity as being, doing Christian deeds. It's Christianity for means of personal empowerment.
I know. It's
crazy. It's a racket, dude. It's a hustle.
Amazing
it's
how hustle. You can. Well, it just shows you can. I just honestly think with this whole fake news thing, we're living in an era where, you could, I could show, I'm holding a white mug here with some lovely tea you made for me. There are people on this that would say, I know you think that mug's so white, funny. But it's kind of black.
Yeah,
it's not white.
I've been doing a bit on stage about that, about false equivalences. Where you have a concrete, like I say, like I'm sitting on a stool, and the response would be like, yeah, but there's a lot of things out there that aren't stools. So, can we really be sure? Yeah,
exactly. I know. Wait, we have to have some parameters. Otherwise, we're going to talk ourselves into a soup.
The way that the truth is being dislodged and then people's ability to actually want to pursue the truth, crazy.
And unfortunately, I think it's like the trouble is,
mm-hmm.
and I hate to say this because it's a very unegalitarian thing to say.
Okay.
It's when what was that thing that Bukowski said about all the smart people are full of self-doubt and all the stupid people are very confident.
Yeah.
Well, that's the era we're living in right now.
What's the Yeats one from Second Coming? Lack all conviction. The best lack all conviction and the worst are filled with passionate intensity.
I know. That's right. That's the slightly clever. I was trying to make it more accessible in my version. But
you broke it down to smart and stupid. He left it a little more vague.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, hell.
But when did it drop out for you? When did you realize, like, hey, maybe this Jesus isn't a flying man?
That stuff went pretty early on, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, really? Yeah. It's kind of crazy.
So you never believed in hell?
Well, I did for a while, and then I was like, and then I met all the liberal, and then I was educated by these brothers that were very liberal, and they were saying, oh, it's okay, don't worry, everything's a metaphor, right?
Oh, yeah, good.
And you go,
Thank God.
That's good. That makes it a little more tangible. And then you go, hang on a second, I don't even buy the metaphor thing. I just think it's just a load of stuff. And you know, hey, there's some really good people, and they don't believe in any of that stuff, and they are really decent, so why do I need that stuff?
Yeah.
It's, you know, the people who are great, really good people. Some of my family are people I've got, you know, I love and I have huge respect for who you know, adhere to that religion.
Yeah, sure.
And there are lots of good people who do, and then there are some people who don't adhere to any of it, and are amazing, wonderful contributors to humanity. You know?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of times people do it out of just the community element, and I think it takes a bit off their plate as parents and stuff.
Of course, and I tell you what, and also the trouble is, there's all these people. What's that Alexander Pope thing? A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Drink deeply or not at all.
Yeah,
we've got a lot of people who have had a little bit of a sip and think that they're Einstein.
Oh no, that is a big problem.
I know
it's
it
weird,
is.
Man.
It's people. It's like confident. There's a lot of these confident people who are saying, "I know all this stuff because someone." I don't know. It makes me think. You know what? In the old days, like 500 years ago, they didn't let ordinary people read the Bible.
Right.
I just think that's a terrible thing. My liberal instincts say that. But when I look around now, I feel like maybe they had a point. So if they read it, they'll get it all wrong.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is that kind of stuff. Like, I believe that if once you buy the Bible, right? So once you sort of believe it, then your brain is open to any other kind of bullshit that makes sense.
Well, the problem is, the thing is, this is what I think about, let me as well just touch on Trump without getting completely consumed by him, is that I think the people who, his base, there's no point arguing with them with intellectual discourse, because it's like talking to someone whose religion is saying, I'm sorry, God doesn't exist because, or talking to creationists or talking to people who have this, it's saying, these are the facts and here's the evidence, and it's like, that doesn't mean anything. I believe.
They believe,
people
that's
just
right.
believe.
And, the thing is,
it doesn't matter what you say.
They're not even talking about evolution or Jesus. They're talking about, you know, Hillary Clinton running a pedophile ring out of a pizza parlor. You know, and then when you do present them with truth, they'll say, that's a good theory.
I know,
so,
I know. And the problem is, it's like, well, you know, one of my barometers for whether I when the alarm bells go off in my head, if I've just met someone new, is if someone mentions a conspiracy theory to
that's
me.
That's it. That's
I'm
it.
Like, I'm done. I'm out. I'm done.
It's just like religion, because you can't prove it.
No.
And
you know, the thing about conspiracy theories is, you say, you know, the truth. If the truth is, okay, there's all these possible theories.
Yeah.
What if the most likely one was the most boring one?
Yeah,
and
it is.
And generally it is. The most likely explanation for someone is the most boring one.
Yeah.
That means you can't stay up late over a drink poring over the infinite details of your infinite, endless conspiracy theories.
It's crazy.
And the truth is normally boring.
Yeah. And I think conspiracy theories, to support the point that we've sort of dragged through the conversation, is that it makes stupid people feel smart.
Oh, it does. It totally does. It's like, and they think that because you don't believe in the conspiracy theories, you drunk the Kool-Aid and they're
one step
ahead.
Yeah,
that drives me nuts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can't engage with that shit. So when did you start, like, when did the comedy start happening?
Well, I just used to watch TV. I just didn't work hard in school, and I did impersonations of teachers at
school.
And that got me, that kind of got me off the hook, because I would have been given a lot of crap, but for the fact that I could do impersonations, so teachers would say, hey, Coogan, come to the front of the class and do impersonations of all the other teachers. And I go, I don't want to do that. And then and they'd say, okay, well, everyone can open their books and we can do some work.
Right.
And then everyone would say, do it, Coogan. And I go, okay. And I go to the front and I do impersonations of the teachers. I take assemblies as teachers. They'd say, you can do the assembly this morning. And
really?
Yeah. And I'd be like 14 and I'd be going up to like 16, 17-year-old kids straightening their ties and telling them to smarten up. And I was like 13 or something like that, because I was impersonating the teacher.
Yeah. And then they would laugh.
And they'd take it. And it got me out of a lot of trouble. And
it also gets you access with other kids, right? You know, it's a way of socializing.
I'm not tough. I wasn't tough. I wasn't a hard nut. And I wasn't super smart, but I had my comedy. But I wasn't the class clown. I was a little bit of a snob. I had my group of friends, and we liked our comedy, and we didn't like... And I had an older brother who was in a rock band. They had some success.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, they were called the Mock Turtles. And they had this.
How old are you?
I'm 53.
I'm 55. Yeah.
I had the older brother. My older brother was cool.
Music
and culture. I mean, you know, there's a headline in the Onion once. It said, "Parents' record collection deemed hilarious." Now that is what my parents had. They had, as my brother pointed out, my parents had snide fake versions of authentic acts. So yeah. We had like an act in our country called Mary Hopkins, who was kind of like a lightweight Joni Mitchell.
Sure.
And then we had the Seekers that were like a lightweight Peter, Paul and Mary.
Right.
And everything was like the kind of fake lowbrow, low grade.
Well, they just were riding the coattails, and this is the angle.
And that was the stuff my parents bought.
No, they like that.
Yeah,
stuff.
That's
the easy listening version.
Yeah, all that version.
Yeah.
And
older is your brother?
5 years older.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would tell me, "This is cool. These are the cool bands. I mean, and this is the cool stuff on TV, not the main channel. This stuff." And I remember he'd say, "Go out and buy this record. There's a single coming out next week. It's called Hong Kong Garden by Susie and the Banshees. Go and buy it because people are going to be talking about it." And I go, "Okay,
yeah."
And that's how I learned about stuff that was off the grid, slightly left field.
And it's weird because I'm the same age as you, but in Britain there was still a big singles market. Like there was like you could go buy 45s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there were tons of them. I remember being there at that time.
Well, that's
briefly
that's,
after high school,
right? Right.
You go to record stores; there are just hundreds of singles.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a music and kind of that was a way of escaping from and making smart choices. I mean, I was a little. I was figuring it out, but I was a little up my own ass. I remember like refusing to go and see Grease, age 13, because I told my friends it was too commercial.
that's the older brother. That's
right. My older brother told me this word. Commercial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so funny.
Was his band a punk band?
They were kind of punk, new wave. It was all. I remember my dad screaming at my brother because he had orange hair for a while and an earring, saying, "What's wrong with you? You look like a girl." You know, like society was breaking down as far as it was in the home because. Yeah. His 18-year-old son was looking androgynous.
So that was like that period was it was in the movie The 24-Hour Party People.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But that would that have been the time? But Susie
yeah,
was,
yeah. Well, it was the early on the time because that
earlier, right? Well, that first wave.
It kind of spanned two periods: 24-Hour Party People, like the end of the 1980s, end of the 1970s, the arrival of Joy Division and the post-punk new wave.
Susie and the Banshees.
Susie and the Banshees were part of that period. They were like new wave post-punk, like after 77, 78, 79. Yeah. A lot of these bands that were kind of a refined punk, wasn't it? New wave.
Right,
And then in the 80s, it became electronic and sort of art. It was like art house kind of cool androgynous bands, and then there was a fallow period, and then there was this period of the Happy Mondays and Stone Roses where guitar bands suddenly
came back
and the movie covers all that period. But I grew up in Manchester, so the guy I play in the movie, Tony Wilson, who discovered those bands and was also a TV presenter, I knew him, and I presented a TV show with him before I played him in a movie.
Oh really?
Yeah,
He was a local celebrity.
He was a local TV presenter, and his other job was he was on the so people knew him. In fact, he was kind of like Tony was a little unwanted because the people who were really cool thought he was a bit of a square.
Like, it's like Murray the K or whatever from whoever that guy was in the old days. Like these DJs, they're like DJs. Yeah. They're not cool, but they're opening the door.
Exactly. Yeah, they wanted to be. It was like the oldest guy at the party.
Yeah.
But also he was. But if you were watching if you saw him as a TV presenter, he seemed like a youthful, edgy TV presenter because his hair was a little long and he sometimes didn't wear a tie.
Right. You know? But like that when in the 70s, because of the older brother, you were, because like in the States, we didn't get that shit till years later.
No.
You know, but you were there. So you had a brother that was on top of it. So you got to experience the Sex Pistols in real time and all those bands in real time.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I bought. I went halves with my buddy on Nevermind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols, and we hid it in a Perry Como sleeve because it had the word bollocks on, which in England was, my father would have considered that a rude word, and he was pretty traditional. Yeah. And so I couldn't have that album cover around.
So you put it in one of their albums?
In a Perry Como, and I'd my buddy would come borrow it, and he would take it to his house in a Perry Como sleeve.
And it was a good record.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
So what were some of the because I don't know, I'm not well versed in British comedy other than talking to people about
it. Well, a lot of sitcoms I used to watch, and I used to Monty Python. Monty Python was a cool, edgy thing, but a lot of comedy in those days, before VCRs, it was on vinyl.
Right.
So you'd listen to comedy,
yeah.
on, even older comedy, like some American comedy. A lot of American comedy was ahead of British comedy, like yeah. in the fit, like
of course,
Bob
yeah.
Newhart and Mel Brooks and stuff like that. And that stuff was on vinyl.
Your parents have that?
Yeah, they had that. So that was a kind of cool bit of the. When my dad had that, and he had like some Peter Sellers stuff. He was in a thing called The Goons, but Peter.
Oh,
Sellers.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was in England. That was yeah. That was that. The Goons were like a pre Monty Python.
Yeah, right. And but so you were growing up with that.
So
but
I,
there yeah. wasn't a huge stand up scene in Britain yet.
No, there was not a huge. It was kind of very old. Regressive. Billy Connolly was this folk.
Yeah, I know Billy. Yeah, I've interviewed
okay.
him. Yeah.
Okay, so he was part of a strain of folk almost like comics.
Storytellers.
Storytellers. They used to come on with the guitar,
yeah.
they'd sing a song, and in between the songs, they'd talk, and, yeah. and the talk got bigger and bigger, and the songs got less and less until eventually they put the guitar down and just talked.
Yeah.
And that's what Billy Connolly came out of. And he was, Billy Connolly was kind of someone you thought, hey, you don't have to tell cheesy gags. You can reel people in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Storytelling.
Yeah.
And that kind of comedy. And so the figures like him were like, they weren't these Oxbridge intellectuals, and neither was he like some blue-collar Joe.
Right.
He was right in the sweet spot between them. That's what Billy Connolly was, because he managed to be smart and yet from a kind of working background.
And I think that his style kind of defined a lot of what was going on in the UK and in Ireland, because like I went to Edinburgh, you know, like 2006. Mm-hmm. And it seems like still that the format for even young comics is like, they're going to put together an hour, they're going to title it, and it's going to be long form. It's not going to be like necessarily punchline efficient. Tommy,
sure.
But Tommy Tiernan's directly yeah. Like
Tommy,
that.
Tommy Tiernan, yeah, he inherited that kind of style.
That's
I mean,
right.
I saw Tommy Tiernan, Irish comedian, 20 years ago, and I was already like getting some traction on TV in the UK,
yeah.
doing my thing. And I saw Tommy Tiernan and was blown away by the purest simplicity of what he did.
And then you saw I saw you did something with that guy. What's his name? Johnny Vegas? Is that?
Yeah, I produced, my company produced a TV series he did.
Because I remember him when he was a stand-up. From mm-hmm. you know, but he's yeah, new yeah. generation. He's,
yeah, yeah. He came way after me. I was like, I mean, I was... before the Pythons, there was like there was the Goons, then there yeah. was Beyond the Fringe. So it was like Peter Sellers, yeah. you'd know. Then there was Dudley Moore and Peter yeah. Cook would be on the Fringe. And after that, there was the Rowan Atkinson and those guys.
He's an interesting talent, isn't he?
Yeah, very quiet, quite sort of enigmatic.
Yeah,
guy.
Yeah, almost old school, like clowning in
yeah,
a way,
yeah.
almost. So, but wait, yeah. did you study like when you went to? Did you study theater and shit?
I just went to theater and did acting, the whole thing, the Stanislavski thing. But
you did.
I just it brought the pants off me. I was thinking, why am I doing yoga? What am I doing? Why am I?
None of it sunk in because you have become a better actor, I think.
Well. What I did was I was doing stuff outside. I was moonlighting, doing, you know, doing voiceover ads. I got more traction from doing ads for local radio stations than I ever did doing any kind of Shakespeare or Chekhov in drama school.
But you did do that stuff.
I did that stuff, yeah. But I was like, and then I started getting.
Were you good at it?
Not really.
No,
I mean, no. I was
because what you wanted to get the laugh.
I just wanted. The thing is, I knew you were supposed to be trying to. I mean, I was quite lowbrow. I just yeah. wanted everything right now, and I
sure.
didn't want to have to tread the boards for no money. And
yeah,
so,
right.
And I got some traction. I got onto a TV show. Oh, doing comedy. I was 22 years old, and I was on this TV talent show in London, but it was pretty cheesy, and I knew it was cheesy, but I thought, hell, it's a gig.
Yeah,
and
it.
I got my foot in the door. Maybe I can get my foot in the door, then I can get smart. And
what'd
then,
you do?
I did like impersonations. I did impersonations of I'm trying to think of people you'd know. So I do like, you know, Michael Caine. I can do like, you know, I could do Michael Caine, but quite well. I know how to do those voices. I know how to speak. It's got that sort of crusty voice like that. I knew how to do people like him.
Sean Connery too, right?
Because you do Sean. A lot of people claim to be. Well, a lot of people claim they do Sean Connery because they go. You show up at a party and everyone goes, "I'm Sean Connery," and they yeah. do that, but they don't get the depth. And that's part of the secret is getting the depth. And if you can't get the depth, there's no point doing it at all. So you do that. And then I learned to do Roger Moore. This sort of accent like this, and like combine people like that, and I do that with people like. I do Sylvester Stallone doing Shakespearean soliloquies.
Oh, yeah, okay.
To be or not to be, that is a question. Whether it is noble in the mind of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take a sidewinder helicopter with
whatever. I do stuff like that, and I was 22, 23. I just throw all this stuff in.
But you had a framework, like that classic sort of impressionist framework where you take the guy and you put him in a situation.
Yeah, so you'd switch it up. So I'd have like Arnold Schwarzenegger as a social worker, right. And I'd have, I do Martin Sheen. I do weird.
Martin Sheen, that seems tricky.
He has a... I normally do. I used to shove some food to the top of my mouth, like a broken biscuit or something. But he speaks like that about the president of the United States. And when he gets angry, it gets real hoarse. His voice gets kind of squeaky like that. It's show like that. Yeah, Martin Sheen.
That's great. So, yeah. You could just drop into that shit.
Yeah. The thing is, I could just do that stuff. And tell you what was good about it was...
Because that's like esoteric. A Martin Sheen impression is... It's unique.
I know. But you just kind of go, hey, I wonder if I can do that guy. I wonder if I can do him... It was, but what's good about it is that if you're trying to get on in this business, you're starting out in the business, you're trying to grab hold of someone's coat saying, look at me, give me a break.
Yeah.
When you do a funny voice like that, you might not show that you've got profound intellect in it,
right.
But very quickly people can go, that's pretty impressive. Yeah, in about 30 seconds, you can impress someone.
Yeah.
And they might not think, but they go, okay, well, he can do that.
Yeah. Right.
That's
right.
Something.
We can work with it.
So then you've got their attention. Then you can say, hey, do you want to see my other stuff?
Yeah, right.
That's not quite so funny. But is,
the rest of the show?
Yeah.
That was the first 10 minutes. And then I'm going to talk about this.
Yeah.
Well, you started working, doing stage work primarily?
I started doing stuff like that, doing clubs and nightclubs. I mean, in Manchester before this, like what they call the alternative comedy circuit, when comedy that had already been established, good stagecraft comedy, stand-up comedy, had been well-established in the US, and it was kind of reborn in the UK in the 1980s. But in Manchester, when I was, there was no room for... It was just kind of...
Working class
stuff that was kind of gag-based and just lazy and crummy. I had to support indie bands to do my comedy. I'd show up a club with some band on stage.
Yeah.
And they'd say, okay, before the band, this guy wants to do some funny voices.
That's tough, man.
Boo, get off. And I'd go on, I'd just ram a few down their throat. And normally, within 30 seconds, some people go, wait a second. He's good.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And then I'd have him, and I'd do like 15 minutes of stuff.
That's how you started.
Yeah, and that's how I started. So it's a baptism of fire. So there was no kind of PC kind of... And I'd go down to London, and then suddenly there were these kind of vegan venues where people would go on and be given a very easy time by the audience because they weren't aggressive. Surprise, surprise.
Well, that's what you get if you... Like, I started in New England doing, like, pubs and shit like that, and you get this edge to you where you're like...
Well, there was one venue in London called the Tunnel Club.
Yeah.
And that was a baptism. If you could survive that, you had respect, and you'd go on stage and they would throw glasses at you. I mean, I think they gave them plastic ones eventually. Yeah. And I got a chair thrown at me. I mean, within 30 seconds, I got a chair thrown at me. And I started doing like really stupid, like kids' TV show voices.
Yeah.
But then screaming, but doing of them. I just did kids' cartoon characters saying obscene things.
Oh, and that
sexual
got him?
Sexual things.
Yeah, yeah.
That was pretty... How can I put it? Accessible
to
even dumb people. And they would go, wait, this is funny.
Yeah.
And then I managed to segue into stuff that was a little smarter.
Yeah.
And I did like 20 minutes and I came on stage and they were chanting more. They said, do you want to go back and do an encore?
Isn't
I said, no,
funny?
Fuck them.
Yeah, right.
I beat them. I'm done. I'm never coming back.
Why risk it?
Yeah.
Fuck it.
I'm out of here. Goodbye.
Don't ever take that second chance.
No, you know no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's how you got the edge.
I ended up writing comedy.
Who was around when you did the club circuit there? You did the Comedy Store and stuff?
I did the Comedy Store and all that for a while.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people like Eddie Izzard, one of my contemporaries. Eddie was, he was.
Before the dress.
Yeah, before the dress. And I remember Eddie starting out. I remember thinking, God, he's terrible.
Yeah.
I was thinking at one point going up to him saying, you're a really nice guy, but you really should quit comedy because it's really not your thing. And he is a testament to tenacious, hard work.
Oh, people can get funny. As a stand-up, you start with guys, you're like, there's never going to turn for this guy. But some dudes... Like, I think you're, you know, because of the impressions, like, some guys are going to go after the comedy. They're going to go after the funny no matter what. Uh-huh. But then there are those dudes that are just, they can't change their speed.
No, no.
And you just look at them and when they're starting out going like, oh, this is going to be a slog. You're not going to make it. But then all of a sudden, it clicks. This innate faith or this inability to do it differently, eventually, if they're persistent, and it sticks.
Yeah, well, it's like that, you know, marching to a different drum.
Yeah, exactly.
You look at the crowd, you're thinking, how long can I not do what everyone else is doing? And then eventually throw the towel and think, I'm going to have to join the crowd and do what they do, because it kind of works.
Some people don't have that. They can't switch.
Yeah, it's. But I'm thinking, is when I was doing comedy, I was thinking, well, I was doing this impersonations and stuff, and I was like, oh, this is so boring. I didn't, other people liked what I did, but I didn't like what I did.
Yeah.
And I figured out, I know a bit of acting, so I'll do stand-up comedy characters rather than just doing stand-up. I'll do a character in front of the microphone and start doing that, and I got some traction with that.
A character of your own creation.
I did about a bunch of different characters. You know, I did a woman and her brother and
so it's like a one-man show thing?
Yeah.
You do it at Edinburgh?
I did it at Edinburgh, and I won the Fringe Award at Edinburgh when I did it in like 26 years ago. And that kind of, I'd already done this cheesy TV shows, but when I won that, that gave me some credibility. It was like, oh, he's not just some cheesy, like, flash in the pan guy.
Yeah.
He can do stuff that's smart and funny.
And then also not an impression.
And there was I didn't do any impressions in that show. Deliberately to see if I could go, hey, and the weird thing was, because I'd done TV, people were like, oh, he's the other funny voice guy.
Yeah.
I was like, no, I can do other stuff. Like, yeah, everyone can do other stuff, whatever, right? So I did the show in Edinburgh and where I did all these characters and it was good.
Is that where Alan Partridge came from, that show?
Just before that, I started doing him on radio with a guy called Patrick Marber, who became a screenplay writer, and he wrote a movie called Closer and Notes on a Scandal, and he's now a successful screenwriter, but he was at the time trying comedy, which he wasn't great at.
So you did a sort of team thing?
Team thing, and I joined him and a guy called Armando Iannucci, who'd done some movies like The Death of Stalin,
saw The Death of Stalin. Yeah. He did that other one, In the Loop?
In the Loop, that you were in.
Didn't he have something to do with Veep, too?
Yeah, he created Veep. So that Armando was the guy I met and started doing radio comedy with, and that's where Alan Partridge came from, working with him.
From radio, isn't it? Yeah. But radio's great, isn't it?
Radio 4, but public, what you have like public, the BBC radio.
Yeah, right.
The good thing about BBC was, and that one of the great things about the BBC is because it was publicly funded through a levy. It's not, no one has it. It's like if you, this is so weird about it. It sounds almost like communist. Like if you own a TV, you have to pay the license fee. And you have no choice over what back in the day, someone who worked at the BBC would go, I like that guy. I'm going to give him a TV series.
And you're on.
There's no market research. There's no like audience testing or seeing how this is measured. It would just be one guy at the seat of his pants go, I like that guy.
That's what happened with Python.
That's right. Sometimes people make mistakes, but really odd, misshapen, genius stuff
finds its way through because
in a way that wouldn't if you just relied on market research
or the development process or sort of like a room full of executives going I don't know.
Well, yeah, there's the old thing that a camel is a horse designed by a committee.
You know? right. Just because it was state run, you didn't have to deal with that process.
No. They just go, okay, give this guy this guy seems to know what he's doing.
Yeah,
and they kind of didn't really interfere much. And in fact,
this guy seems to know what he's doing. Well, give it a try. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah. And it's like, and it's not my money. It's like the government's money.
Yeah, fuck it.
So that meant you could do stuff that was just different.
Is that why some things only like? Because I've noticed it, and I respect it a great deal, but I don't think it's necessarily intentional that some of the greatest British sitcoms are only like three seasons or two seasons or four seasons.
Well, Fawlty Towers is like there was two seasons of that. I mean,
The Office too was only three
seasons and a couple of specials. That's right.
So the radio plays. So that was the first time you started writing scripted bits.
Yeah, and we didn't have team writers like you do in the States. So people get burnt out more quickly. And there's like things are written by like two people. Maybe. Right. Mostly they're written by two people, and they go, I'm done. I just did like.
I did 90 things. Yeah.
So I've done everything. And yeah. So whereas here you have it's more of a Okay. Yeah, well, the Americans have always been good at getting an idea and going, how can we make this generate as much capital as possible
for us? That's right.
Whereas the Brits have never been great at that.
Yeah.
They have a good idea. In fact, a lot of good ideas we have, and then the Americans go, okay, we can now we can mass produce this.
No, we'll take it. We'll buy it from them.
And we'll make it so everyone can have it.
Right. But I don't know. Who do they pay for those things? I mean, how does that work? Have you sold a TV show?
Well, we try to. I have a production company. We make some shows over that. We have a show that was called Camping that Lena Dunham is doing an American version.
That was yours?
Yeah.
So that was sold the regular way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when you're saying that when you do the BBC thing, you're like, you're going to get experience writing, acting, producing. Yeah.
We would go along and we record the show for the BBC. We'd go have lunch.
Yeah.
And we'd be having lunch and we go, we have an idea at lunch.
Yeah.
And then that afternoon we'd go and record it and it would be broadcast at the end of the week.
So, yeah.
I mean, there was a fast turnaround of stuff. And so that, I was sort of saying, well, I want to write and I want to do more serious stuff as well. And so
how did how many versions of the Alan Partridge Show did you do?
We did like 1, 2, 3 TV series in the UK. We did one talk show and then we did two sitcoms. Then we went and did some stuff on radio and stuff for Sky. Mm-hmm. Sky.
That's Murdoch's thing?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
And we did two series for that. And then now we're back on the BBC.
Really?
So we're back in the. We just finished a TV series that starts next February.
Another Alan Partridge series.
It's another Alan Partridge series, but this one is like a magazine type show. So it's like a sort of a morning thing with a female and male co-presenter.
And you've aged him?
He's a little. Well, he's as old as he would be. He's always been about 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
Which has worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
But as I'm getting older, I'm catching up with him and slowing his age down. So I think he's about 7 years older than me now. But yeah, we've got like a new. It's a great. I'm really excited about the show. It's the thing where Alan tackles serious topics, like the whole Me Too thing.
Uh-huh.
There's a whole episode about that. Because people are saying. That's such a difficult thing to talk about for anyone to say anything about. But if you're doing a character,
it weirdly
gives you this license to, you can get things wrong in a big way. And it's fine because it's him doing it. And also you're not sanctioning or agreeing with what he's saying. You're saying this guy gets things wrong. So you have license to do it. And this is the crucial thing. Because you've got a comic character, he can say stuff that you go, that is so off message. But sometimes he can say stuff that's true that you don't, that I can't say. The Emperor's New Clothes.
Exactly.
So the fool can point something out. The fool can point something out that everyone secretly knows to be true.
It's a good point because when you're telling me this, my first reaction is that there's no dialogue around that stuff. So, men in general are sort of like, I'm not going to.
Of course. But
so when you can just do a character that is already an asshole and insensitive.
You can kind of have your cake and eat it because you can say, and what we do is we have him trying to jump on the bandwagon and say, you know, hey, you know, I mean, he says, I want to apologize. I've made mistakes. I've stood on the side of the sidewalk and tried to, and slow hand clapped while I watch a woman try to parallel park. You know, and I feel bad about that. And now, if I saw a woman doing it now, I would shout instructions.
I'm afraid to laugh on the mic. Yeah. That's how terrified.
I know. Yeah, but the point is, it's him, and we have actors. You know, we have feminists on the show, putting that point of view, and we have actors playing. Both sides, and
so
I have a female
conversation. In an exaggerated way, you're actually servicing the side of the dialogue that is not enabled.
Yes, exactly, and doing it in a kind of a, it's weird because it's a safe environment. You're not saying that he's right,
right?
And you're not saying he's wrong, or you endorse it, and sometimes it enables you to sprinkle a little humanity on arguments that become very atrocious.
Yeah.
Right. That's what it does. And even now, you see, I'm choosing my words very goddamn carefully. But I am, you know, because you kind of have to.
There's nothing unreasonable, you know, about the intent of what's happening, right?
No, and so, you know what? I'll say this about the when you do when you when you're writing comedy, I feel like I'm very ethical when I write comedy. What I mean is, I don't mean that I'm sanctimonious about it. But what you do when you write comedy is you feel okay. I don't like to use comedy to attack people who don't have any power.
Right.
Some people do that, and I don't like it. It's like, hey,
punch up, don't punch down.
Yeah, punch up, of course. And a lot of people don't get that, but to me, it's like you have to do that. There's kind of ethical responsibility. And are you laughing at a prejudice, or is the prejudice why you're laughing? You know, and now I don't sit there marking myself, but intuitively, that's what I want to do.
And so also, you also have the parameters of the character. So because when you start doing character work and you're making these characters up, you're infusing them with the humanity. So once you understand, certainly Alan Partridge, you know, Bottom, you understand the depth of that guy. So you can also sort of temper it with that. Like, is this gratuitous? Is this something he wouldn't say? Is it within the realms of the humanity of the character? Because that's what's going to ground it in the humanity.
Yeah. You can't be a monster. You can't. If you create someone who's just obnoxious, then, you know, and he's sometimes ignorant and prejudiced. But the one thing is, he tries to do the right thing. Early on, we made him a little too sort of unreconstructed and a little too predictably conservative, that looked like shooting fish in a barrel.
A caricature.
Whereas now we do him as someone who's like, who realizes that he's got to get on message, as it were, and someone is struggling to do the thing he's supposed to.
Not unlike a lot of men his age.
Yeah, and a bit like, well, sometimes, I mean, like, you know, it's, I remember, you know, my father, late father, trying to be, you know, it's like my mom saying, you know, like the older generation getting to grips with being enlightened about gay relationships.
Yeah, gay people.
And getting to the stage where my mom can say, and does he have a friend? You know.
But that's what, like, before Trump came in, you know, when I would talk about the nature of, because tolerance is what it is. It's what it is. In order for democracy to work, or to have a social fabric that's at all progressive, people have to engage tolerance. And that means, like, it starts off with guys going like, oh, fuck the gays, fuck this shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But as it becomes culturally infused and fought for, they're like, well, it's not for me, but it's fine.
Yeah, it's moving. And some people are, you know, people are open to that. And I kind of like, if people, it's all to do with the intention. I remember what's your intention?
Yeah.
What's your intention? Is your intention to be mean spirited, or is your intention to try and do the right thing? And that's really the measure of what, you know, is it sincere, or is it, what's the motivation behind something?
And also that just that conversation or weighing that stuff out, it gives the characters depth, which is what, like, when I watched Stan and Ollie, that, you know, having seen you do not a lot of stuff, I didn't grow up watching you do impressions or without Alan Partridge, but just seeing that movie and having experienced, you know, Philomena, The Trip, the, you know, Tropic Thunder, 24-Hour Party People, like seeing a lot of films that you're in, was that, you know, I grew up, my grandfather, I'm your age, so in New Jersey, the Laurel and Hardy stuff was on. So it's part of my childhood, knowing that those guys. But these are two guys that not a lot of people know anymore. And but if you do know them, they're just these broad clown characters. And the fact that you were able, both of you, to give them such humanity and depth at that stage in their career and behind the scenes was kind of mind-blowing to me. That, like, because, like, knowing now how adept you are at impressions, you still had to fill this guy out, you know, on the level of having heart and also exploring that relationship.
Yeah, well, I mean, taking this job on, first of all, you're right about anyone under 40, like, who the hell are those guys? And then you show them a photograph, and they go, oh, the fat guy and the thin guy that wear those bowler hats. Yeah,
right,
I know those
guys.
They kind of know the image, but
it doesn't matter, by the way, to see the film.
No, it doesn't. You don't need to know who they are. I wanted to do this because, A, growing up, they were very important to me. But really, beyond that, what they did, to me, it's a bunch of things, but I was trying to sort of sum it up. I think it's a love letter to comedy.
I think that's true. I could see that.
That a way of celebrating those, because I've spent a few years in comedy and as well as writing, moving into sort of dramatic stuff, and it's kind of there's a sweet spot where comedy to me as an end in itself is a great thing that you can do, but it's when I did Philomena, I thought comedy's more useful as a way to sugar the pill of difficult subject matter. You know, if you make people laugh, they're not scared. You don't feel like they're going into a lecture. You go, hey, you can laugh at this stuff. You can laugh at bad stuff. And you can learn about it. And hey, learning can be fun, right?
Right,
you
know? Sure.
With Stan and Ollie, it was a way of saying, you know, we see, I was thinking about going back and doing the research on the movie that Jeff wrote. Jeff, who wrote Philomena with me, he wrote Stan and Ollie by himself. But
What compelled him?
He would just, I do know that he thought that he knew that they'd done tours of Europe in their 50s and wondered why the hell were they touring 20 years after their heyday, doing live gigs in Europe, and then started to do some digging. And it was they were broke. Why were they broke? Because Hal Roach stiffed them on the deals.
Yeah.
And so he started to learn more about them. And then from that came this idea of looking at the relationship between two men who known each other their whole lives, and people have come and gone in their professional life, wives have come and gone, but at the end of the day, all they have is each other, and it's about learning. It becomes a metaphor for living with each other, of understanding the person who's in the same space as you.
And also, in terms of the love letter to comedy, what was sort of amazing about it, no matter how begrudgingly they were doing these tours or how they were getting screwed, and even with their popularity dissipating, if at all, being a nostalgia act, is that once they took the stage and did those bits, and they worked every fucking time, no matter how many people were there, you know, as a comic, you see that. Those questions are answered. It's like you see guys who are older than you and I, who have been doing the same act for 20 years, but they get out there and they do it and they're in it. And then, you know, whatever happens off stage is what happens off stage, but that professionalism.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, we all know about the other tiers of the clown and the kind of, you know, that, you know, what the darkness behind the humor, but nobody looks at it and looks at the humanity of something, which I think is the old cliche about laughter being the best medicine. You know, it's never been more apparent to me how important it is now. And I remember I did a lot of live stuff on stage, a couple of tours where I do big audiences before I got into doing the movie stuff.
Yeah.
And I used to look into the audience, and this is something I think helped me identify with Stan Laurel, who wrote the comedy. It was that there's something incredibly powerful that we underestimate, because we look at comedy, you think it makes you laugh, it must be lowbrow, it makes this visceral reaction. It's one of the few things, apart from something that touches you emotionally, can make you cry, but that's that can be a silent thing unless you're bawling your eyes out. But when you find something funny, we all make this noise.
Yeah.
It's unambiguous.
Yeah.
There's no gray area.
Yeah.
If you didn't make that noise, you didn't find it funny. If you didn't laugh, it's not funny. There's no, it's unambiguous.
Yes.
Now, if you have a big crowd of people and they all laugh at the same time, there's a lack of bullshit in that.
Yeah.
They're laughing. That means they found it funny. That's indisputable.
Right.
Now, you've got a group of people in that crowd, and I might be 2,000 people in a venue, it might be millions of people watching something on the screen. They can be have the most diverse political views, the most diverse ethnicity, religion.
Right.
But if they all laugh in that one moment, they're all unified in that moment, however fleeting it is, when they all laugh at the same time. That's, when you think about it that way, in that regard, it's mind-blowing.
Oh, sure.
That you can make all these people who might otherwise be at each other's throats be in complete union in a moment. And that's what the greatest comedy does. And it was kind of like that the respect for that, and the fact that Stan, that Laurel and Hardy, when you look at some of their movies, some of their best stuff, it is timeless and quite nuanced, because it works as in a childlike way. You know, when a brick falls on Oliver Hardy's head and he takes his bowler hat off and rubs his sore head, and then another one lands on his head, then another one. You know? I mean, it's kind of like it's never goes in or out of fashion, that stuff.
But
you see the expressions, there's a humanity to it, and a kind of love of humanity. That comedy they do is never vicious, mean, or cynical.
Yeah.
When I was looking back at the movies, it occurred to me, I thought, shit, they were making this stuff while fascism was on the rise in Europe.
Yeah.
And the Great Depression was sweeping this country.
Yeah.
And yet they were doing this stuff that just made people laugh.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's That's pretty powerful, understanding the context.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in making this movie, we just wanted to, I think in some ways, tell a story about something that's important. And people who have the ability to make people laugh and unify people like that, that's important and is worth saluting.
And also, like, be it a love story to comedy, it's also a love story about a relationship between two guys.
Sure.
Who, you know, who despite, you know, whatever their emotional liabilities were or whatever they were unable to communicate, had this depth of feeling for each other. That, yeah. And that was sort of a fascinating,
you know,
thing.
You see, well, you do see it in, you know, when you see some of those political, I saw a documentary on John McCain mm-hmm. the other day and about
him and Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, and yeah. And it showed his friendship with Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And when you see people who don't agree with each other but have love and respect for each other, that's where the hope of humanity is in people who see beyond, you know, their
ideology
and their differences and find a way through.
Yeah.
However imperfect that way through is. There's never going to be a gold at the end of the rainbow.
Right.
But there's a kind of a way through by people accommodating those. I mean, you know, you can do that to an extent. I mean, if someone says, I want to kill or wipe out a whole race of people, that's pretty, there's no kind of, there's no compromise on that. That's,
yeah.
That's when, you know, the chips are down. You have to just stand up against that stuff.
That's right,
But beyond that, people, you know, there are people who disagree fundamentally,
yeah.
but are equally noble.
And also, like, maybe, you know, there's that sort of thing with people where you may not know why, you may not understand it, but emotionally they're connected.
Sure.
You know, whether it's noble or not, you know, they get along on a level that's not necessarily explainable.
No, and do you know what? However much they, because the normal narrative of Laurel and Hardy is
yeah.
that they're trying to get some scam, they're trying to struggle, they're kind of blue collar workers, they're kind of a little poor in their
yeah,
ways.
Yeah.
But they're trying to get on it, and Stan Laurel screws it up for Oliver Hardy. And however mad Oliver Hardy gets, at the end of it, he still goes, come on! You know, it's like he can't bear his buddy, but he never abandons his buddy.
Yeah, there's a surrender to it.
Yeah.
Another thing the movie shows, if you don't remember it, or is that they, despite the fact that they were Hal Roach players, they may not have known each other before,
and
the outfit, you know, the bowler hats were something that was established by Chaplin or whatever,
uh-huh, mm-hmm.
was that they are totally unique. Mm-hmm. In their presentation and in their act, there's nobody like them.
No, they were put together. They were like the kind of they were like the monkeys of the
right.
pop world. You know,
like, it's like we were talking about before, your parents' records. That there was a lot going on culturally yeah. that was popular in comedy, and they mm-hmm. were and Hal Roach mm-hmm. wanted to
the
capitalize.
The monkeys
on
had
that.
Some great songs.
Couple,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know? So they discovered these characters. They created these characters. Interestingly, Chaplin and Stan Laurel came over from England on the boat together, and Stan Laurel was Charlie Chaplin's understudy. In fact, you can see photographs of Stan Laurel wearing the Charlie Chaplin clothes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. With the mustache and the bolt and the stick, the walking stick.
At United Artists or before?
Before yeah. that, when they were yeah. doing the stuff live.
Oh, okay.
Before
okay.
he got the so, but Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy, you know, did that stuff together. Stan Laurel did all the work behind the scenes.
So when you, like, I talked to Dick Van Dyke, you know.
Dick Van Dyke, okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
This is okay. You can tell me.
He just like okay. he tells a story about when he got to Hollywood and how much he loved Stan Laurel, and then mm-hmm. he just looked him up in the phone.
That's
book,
right.
And he called him.
I know
he had a relationship with him.
I know that's right. I was going to go on and say is that the research that I did on Stan Laurel was because he was in the phone book. Dick Van Dyke, you know, famously called him up, but a bunch of other people just phoned up Stan Laurel and recorded the conversations down the phone.
Really?
Yeah, on tape recorders, and so there was a bunch of recordings of Stan Laurel
that
down the phone that I listened to of Stan Laurel just talking about Laurel and Hardy. He would talk to anyone who rang up. He would give them the time. I think he said to Dick Van Dyke, I think he said, does your mother know you're calling?
Yeah.
It's a trunk call and, yeah. you know, it's going to cost a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was how...
So this was in the late 50s, early 60s. Stan died in 65.
Yeah.
And, but those phone calls a real eye-opener to not only the rhythms of his speech, but how he used to think.
Yeah.
He was like cantankerous about certain things, like, he was a jackass. And you hear him being kind of quite rude about some people,
yeah,
which is nice to hear somehow.
Right.
Because he's the hapless kind of idiot, but right. he's the powerhouse of generating stuff. And he said when talkies came in,
uh-huh.
before that, Laurel and Hardy made the transition very well. He said, when talkies came in, he said, people were talking nine to the dozen. They were just wouldn't shut up on movies because they could talk suddenly. He said, but me and Ollie, we just kept it to a minimum and we stuck to what we knew worked.
Yeah.
So they kept the physical stuff. They put a few words in here and there. They didn't go crazy just because they could speak,
right.
which a lot of movies at that time did.
Yeah.
People went, yada, yada, all the way through.
Yeah.
They didn't do that.
So
that was interesting. That's a smart way to adapt.
Yeah. Right? And also,
throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right. So for you, like, since you have this natural ability to sort of, become, to take on an impression, so these phone calls and the research you did were able to inform this impression into a full character.
Yeah. Look, when you people say, what's it like when you play a real character? If a blank page is more difficult. At least you've got someone who lived a life and they've done a bunch of, they've done the research for you. Stan Laurel has left behind a footprint in the movies he did, in some of these conversations, in a few books, his letters. This stuff there.
Yeah, and also the thing was is that, biopics can go either way depending on how familiar people are with who it's about. Like, if that person's still alive or it's relatively mm-hmm. contemporary, you're up against this sort of he doesn't quite look like him, but uh-huh. he kind of
mm-hmm.
got him.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys are far enough in the past, and the makeup and the attention to detail was so what it was. But I feel, as a biopic, the depth of it is much different than anything I've ever seen before.
Because it doesn't really, it's got to work. It has to work.
Yeah.
If you don't know who they are, you just need to look at it and say, this is about a relationship between two guys who are funny, and show them being funny. And if you show them being funny on stage, and then you see, okay, this is what goes behind people who do that funny stuff, and you just see the like any kind of relationship, you see the tensions, you see the arguments, the kind of the baggage that people carry
sure.
around in relationships, and they let it fester, and then somebody bursts up, and then you either resolve it or you don't.
Yeah.
And
but the sort of onstage personas, and the backstage, offstage realities was done so well. So how did you and John work it out?
First of all, you talked about me doing impersonations. The way I did it, John was a little different from me, but the way I did it was, I thought, well, I know how he talks. He sort of speaks like this. He has a kind of strange way of talking. It's like mid-Atlantic. It's kind of a little bit British, but it's also slightly American. You can't quite place it.
Yeah.
And he throws his arms up and has these strange expressions where he can't quite show what. You see him do about four or five expressions in the space of 30 seconds. Each one with a completely different thought process.
Yeah.
And you see it in his face. It's almost like, because you have this stuff on screen and then there's some conversations, it's like, well, I know the outside superficialities of his character,
uh-huh.
the physicality, and you can use that as a way of going back into the character a little.
Yeah.
You go, okay, well, I've got a handle on him, and now I can develop it by doing some research. It's like working backwards.
Yeah.
Like you go,
right.
Well, I've got the answer. I just got to figure out what the question is.
Okay, yeah.
And that was kind of how I went about bringing Stan to life. Now, we had, we spent 4 weeks in rehearsal. John C. Reilly playing Oliver Hardy and I sat in a rehearsal room for 4 weeks, and we learned these dance routines. We learned some of the physical stuff. We had clown advisor.
And he loves clowns.
He was a clown for a while
early
on. And we had this guy called Toby Sedgwick who taught us how to walk, taught us how to move. We had to learn dance routines. We had to learn dance routines that they did.
Yeah.
And then learn their mistakes and put the mistakes in as well.
Oh, right.
It's like a band. We had to learn each move meticulously and then make it messy.
Yeah.
Like a good band that can play tight.
You had to make it like they would do it.
Yeah. And then play it, be loose.
Yeah.
Make it, give it that jazz element.
Yeah.
That where things are not quite, detune your guitar slightly.
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing.
Was it fun?
It was great fun. It was hard work, but it was fun. And that was but in doing it together, John and I got to know each other. We became friends the same way that, we were saying, hey, this is just like Stan and Ollie were put together. We've been put together. Let's find out who we are.
Yeah.
Let's learn to trust each other. And we got on great, became the it was all designed to make the movie work, but but the byproducts of that was that we became, of course, inevitably we became very good friends because we were living in each other's pockets and having to take care of each other on screen and guide each other a little too, you know, like look out for me and like, hey, you know, when you did that thing, it was better the first time you did it.
Oh, right.
Okay, what about me? You know, you constantly
trusted there, each other,
saying, hey, give me some feedback. What do you think of that? That was pretty good, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we can do? You know, it's great.
It must have been a very, like, because I was a really, and I'm not cynical, but I'm judgmental. You know, I was like completely blown away by both of the performances and the movie itself. I thought it was great, and I didn't know what to expect. When I saw the trailer, I was like, holy shit, this is like, this is going to be insane. And it just like, it doesn't matter if you know who they are. You know, it's really an interesting portal into not only a past time, but the sort of kind of eternal dynamic of you know, relationship and guys.
I feel like there's especially right now where any conversation, because of the world we're living in, most conversations where differences of opinions are had tend to spiral and escalate into this kind of, you know, biblical meltdown.
Yeah,
time and again.
Yeah,
and it's just about two people figuring out a way through the fucking mess.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. And was it rewarding for you? I mean, in terms of, you know, what you've done in your career as an actor?
It was. Yeah, I mean, I did this when I wrote this film Philomena a few years ago that you mentioned, and that was, to me, that was a kind of a little epiphany for me, because I was like, hey, you know, comedy isn't just an interesting thing in itself. It's more interesting as a component as a tool or a weapon to use to try and tell stories
to keep people's heart open.
And storytelling. You know, that's what I sort of fell in love with. And I was thinking, like, I keep thinking about the political and the global landscape and everything of people who are at each other's throats and the atrocious nature of any kind of discussion.
Yeah.
And when you put comedy into something, it just softens things. People just are more open to something. It's like any kind of storytelling. If you have an intellectual discourse, you and I could have an argument about some political argument where I present all the merits of my evidence and blah, 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 and you could do the same. We're never really going to, I mean, you might accommodate a little bit of it, but really, if you really want to make people think about that, it's the idea of consider, wasn't it, Oliver Cromwell said, you know, I beg you in the depth of Christ, consider it possible you may be wrong. You know, just the notion of self-doubt, that's a healthy thing.
Right, sure.
To think you might not be right about something.
I'm very healthy then.
You know, it's just a good thing. And I think, but the only thing that really makes people think about that stuff is if you tell a story.
Yeah.
I mean, but the Bible is full of stories.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's not about... you tell a story. If the story touches someone, it'll make them think about something.
Oh, absolutely.
Way more powerfully than a whole spreadsheet of statistics.
And you've done also, like, some of the other movies, you've been part of, like, because really, you know, good satire is not, there's not a lot of it. And I think that, you know, the British are a little better at it generally. But also, I think Tropic Thunder is one of the greatest satirical movies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's a really deep movie.
Yeah, it is. It's about, the funny thing is, you're right. I think you're right. It's about something.
Yeah.
The point is, it's not just funny. It's about something.
Yeah.
About something that's about human nature.
Right.
It says something about human
nature. And also show business. And
vanity and show business and shallowness and narcissism. But it's a commentary on something. Unfortunately, I think because it's comedy, things like that get, because they don't wear their importance on their sleeve.
Right.
Comedy, by its very nature, doesn't wear its importance on its sleeve. Because it makes you laugh. So you think, well, it can't be that important. And of course, it can be.
I think it's underrated in terms of the intelligence of the whole thing. How did you get involved with that?
I knew Stiller I can't remember what, but I knew him just because he knew my stuff and I knew his stuff. And I think he came to London and met me and said, hey, I really dig your stuff. And I said, well, I dig your stuff. And he said, well, will you do? And then And I did those Night at the Museum movies with him. I think that might have been after.
I think it's
after. But anyway, but he said, come and play. Will you play the director? The British director. Interestingly, he said, the funny thing is, I wore, for some reason, I don't know why, but I was playing the British director. I think he wanted me to seem dislikable, but I wore a Confederate flag. I wore a Confederate flag on my, it wasn't my choice.
Yeah.
They put a Confederate flag right. on my shirt.
Yeah.
And because I was playing the British director, I don't know the associate, why that choice was made. But anyway, when they tested the movie, Ben said, the only thing people didn't like about the movie was the Confederate flag. And they digitally removed it from every frame.
That's crazy.
Of me. Yeah, yeah. So that I just had a plain blue T-shirt on.
I wouldn't have noticed that.
Yeah, but I think in the trailer, there may be somewhere online, there's a trailer where I'm still wearing it, like a...
Do you like doing that kind of stuff where you're really cut, like even the political comedy with
anything which is, you know, I like, I've done a lot of comedy that which is edgy and but I like doing stuff which is Laurel and Hardy, Stan and Ollie as it's called, is quite a sort of a gentle thing.
Sure. And it's always the trip too. That I mean, that was kind of a relationship of two older guys.
It is
guys.
Actually,
similar.
It is similar in a lot of ways, actually. Yeah, yeah. The trip about two middle-aged guys trying to figure out life.
Yeah, I like that.
But
movie.
I think I don't know what it is. I think when you're younger, it's like
got more to prove.
You want to be the comedy I did was sort of more acerbic and fun and cynical. But it's like, I know, it's like wearing, it's like kind of giving the finger to the establishment, and then when you. If you're over 40 and you're giving people the finger, it's not a good look.
Well, I love the movie. And it was great talking to you. I'm glad you took the time to do it. Thanks for hanging out.
Hey, Mark, I like it a lot. I like your garage. I don't know why you've got a hammer on the
table.
A half a hammer. Is that for me to attack you or you to attack me? I don't know.
Whatever you feel like doing with it. Generally, neither has happened. People just ask what the fuck has happened. I found it somewhere and it was on the table in the old garage. So now it's over here. Mm. So how long are you in town for?
3 days, and I'm flying to Monaco to do it. Actually, Michael Winterbottom, I'm doing another movie with him. I'm doing a movie about a rich billionaire bastard.
Are you him?
I'm him. Yeah.
How's the script? Good? Funny?
It's funny. He's like a super rich guy who has super yachts and big parties and employs people in sweatshops in Sri Lanka to make his clothes super super cheap so he can sell them on the high street.
And does he have an existential moral crisis at the end of Act Two?
No, he's a bastard all the way through, and then he dies. So that's refreshing.
Unpredictable. Thanks, man. We'll have a good trip.
Okay, dude. Thanks.
Go see that movie, folks. That was Steve Coogan, who did an amazing job. And the movie's just great. Stan and Ollie playing now in New York and California. It opens everywhere on Friday, January 18th. Okay. We don't need no stinking wall. Dig it. I'm going to play some guitar. Some slightly border-tinged guitar, I think. It's got a little echo to it. It's got a twang, a little Tex-Mexy. Maybe not. Maybe it's just me doing what I do at the end of the show.
Lives. Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.